Witch Hazel, as told through the eyes of my daughter. November is not a time for flowers. The day is short and cold. Heavy clouds drag at my mood, and sleet, like a muttered curse, propels me indoors. I'm reluctant to venture out again. So when the sun breaks through for that rare yellow day, maybe the last before the snow falls, I have to go. Because the woods are quiet this time of year, without leaves or birds, the buzz of a bee seems inordinately loud. Intrigued, I follow her path. What could bring her out in November? She makes directly for bare branches, which, when I look more closely, are strewn with yellow flowers. Witch hazel. The flowers are a ragged affair, 5 long petals, each like a scrap of fading yellow cloth that's snagged on the branch, torn strips that wave in the breeze. But oh, are they welcome, a spot of color when months of gray lie ahead, a last hurrah before winter that suddenly reminds me of a November long ago. The house had stood empty since she left. The cardboard Santas she had pasted on the tall windows were faded from shafts of summer sun, and plastic poinsettias on the table were draped in cobwebs. You could smell that the mice ransacked the pantry while the Christmas ham turned to mounds of mold in the icebox after the power was shut off. Outside on the porch, a wren built its nest in the lunchbox again, awaiting her return. Asters bloomed in profusion under the sagging clothesline, where a gray cardigan was still pinned. I first met Hazel Barnett when I was walking the fields in Kentucky, looking for wild blackberries with my mother. We were bent to our picking when I heard a high voice from the hedgerow call, "Howdy do, howdy do!" And there at the fence stood the oldest woman I'd ever seen. Slightly afraid, I took my mother's hand as we walked over to greet her. She supported herself by leaning against the fence among the pink and burgundy hollyhocks. Her iron-gray hair was drawn into a bun at the back of her neck, with a corona of white wisps standing out like sun rays around her toothless face. "I like to see your light at night," she said. "It feels real neighborly. I seen y'all out walking and come to say hi-dy." My mother introduced herself, explained we'd moved in a few months ago. "And who is this little bundle of joy?" she asked, leaning over the barbed wire to pinch my cheek. The fence pressed into the loose breast of her house dress, where pink and purple flowers, like the hollyhocks, were fading from many washings. She wore bedroom slippers outside in the garden, something my mother would never allow. She stuck her wrinkled old hand over the fence, veiny and crooked, with a wire-thin band of gold loose on her ring finger. I'd never heard of a person named Hazel, but I've heard of Witch Hazel and was quite certain that this must be the witch herself. I held my mother's hand even tighter. I suppose, given the way she is with plants, there was a time when some might have called her witch. There is something eerie about a tree that flowers so far out of season and then spits its seeds, shiny pearls as black as midnight, 20 feet into the quiet fall woods, with a sound like an elfin footfall. She and my mother became unlikely friends, trading recipes and garden tips. By day, my mother was a professor at the college in town, sitting at her microscope, writing scientific articles. But spring twilight found her barefoot in the garden, planting beans and helping me fill my pail with earthworms that were severed by her shovel. I thought I could nurse them back to health in the worm hospital I constructed beneath the irises. She encouraged me in this, always saying, "There is no hurt that can't be healed by love." Before dark, many evenings, we would wander across the pasture to the fence and meet Hazel. "I do like to see your light in the window," she said. "There ain't nothing better than a good neighbor." I listened while they discussed putting stove ash at the base of tomato plants to keep off the cutworms, or Mama bragged on how fast I was learning to read. "Lord, she's a quick study, ain't you, my little honeybee?" Hazel said. Sometimes she had a wrapped peppermint in her dress pocket for me, the cellophane old and soft around it. The visits progressed from the fence line to the front porch. When we baked, we would take over a plate of cookies and sip lemonade on her sagging stoop. I never liked to go in the house, an overwhelming jumble of old junk, trash bags, cigarette smoke, and what I now know as the smell of poverty. Hazel lived in the little shotgun house with her son Sam and daughter Janie. Janie was, as her mother explained, simple, on account of she came late in life, her mother's last child. She was kind and loving and always wanting to smother my sister and me in her deep, soft arms. Sam was disabled, couldn't work, but received some veterans' benefits and pension from the coal company that they all lived on. Barely. When he was well enough to go fishing, he would bring us big catfish from the river. He coughed like crazy, but had twinkling blue eyes and a world of stories, having been overseas in the war. Once he brought us a whole bucket of blackberries he'd picked along the railroad track. My mom tried to refuse that big pail as too generous a gift. "Why, don't talk nonsense," Hazel said. "They aren't my berries. The Lord done made these things for us to share." My mother loved to work. For her, a good time was building stone walls or clearing brush. On occasion, Hazel would come over and sit in a lawn chair under the oaks while Mama stacked stones or split kindling. They would just talk about this and that, Hazel telling about how she liked a good woodpile, especially when she used to take in washing to earn a little extra. She needed a goodly pile to fuel her wash tubs. She had worked as a cook in a place down by the river, and she shook her head at the number of platters she could carry at one time. Mama would tell her about her students or a trip she'd taken, and Hazel would wonder at the very idea of flying in an airplane. And Hazel would tell about the time she was called out to deliver a baby in a snowstorm, or how people would come to her door for healing herbs. She said how some other lady professor had once come with a tape recorder to talk to her and was going to put her in a book on account of all the old ways she knew. But the professor had never come back, and Hazel'd never seen the book. I half listened to talk about gathering hickory nuts under the big trees or carrying a lunch pail to her daddy, who worked making barrels at the distillery down by the river. But my mother was charmed by Hazel's stories. I know my mother loved being a scientist, but she always said that she was born too late. Her real calling, she was sure, was to be a 19th-century farm wife. She sang while she canned tomatoes, stewed peaches, punched down the dough for bread, and was insistent that I learn how too. When I think back on her friendship with Hazel, I suppose that the deep respect they had for each other was rooted in such things. Both were women with feet planted deep in the earth, who took pride in a back strong enough to carry a load for others. Mostly I heard their talk as a drone of grown-up chatter, but one time, when my mother was coming across the yard with a big armload of wood, I saw Hazel drop her head in her hands and cry. "When I lived at home," she said, "I could carry a load like that. Why, I could carry a bushel of peaches on one hip and a baby on the other without hardly trying. But now it's all gone, gone with the wind." Hazel was born and raised over in Jessamine County, Kentucky, just down the road. To hear her talk, though, it might have been hundreds of miles away. She couldn't drive, nor could Janie or Sam, so her old house was as lost to her as if it lay across the Great Divide. She had come here to live with Sam when he had a heart attack on Christmas Eve. She loved Christmas, all the folks coming by, cooking a big dinner, but she dropped everything that Christmas, locked her door, came to live with her son and look after him. She hadn't been back home since, but you could see that her heart ached for the place. She would get a faraway look in her eyes when she spoke of it. My mother understood this, the longing for home. She was a northern girl, born in the shadow of the Adirondacks. She had lived lots of places for graduate school and research, but always thought she'd go back home. I remember the fall she cried for missing the blaze of red maple. She was transplanted to Kentucky, by dint of a good job in my father's career, but I know she missed her own folks in the woods of home. The taste of exile was as much in her mouth as it was in Hazel's. As Hazel grew older, she got sadder and would talk more and more about the old times, the things she would never see again. How tall and handsome her husband Rowley had been. How beautiful her gardens were. My mother once offered to take her back to see her old place, but she shook her head. "Oh, that's mighty nice of you, but I couldn't be beholden like that. Anyway, it's gone with the wind," she would say. "All gone." But one fall afternoon, when the light was long and gold, she phoned up. "Now, honey, I know your hands and heart are full, but if there was any way you could see fit to drive me back to the old place, I'd be right thankful. I need to see to that roof before the snow flies." My mother and I picked her up and drove up the Nicholasville Road toward the river. It's all four-lane now, with a big span across the Kentucky River. So high, you hardly know it's flowing, muddy, below you. At the old distillery, boarded up and empty now, we left the highway and drove down a little dirt road that angles back away from the river. Hazel began to cry in the back seat the minute we made the turn. "Oh, my dear old road," she cried, and I patted her hand. I knew what to do, for I'd seen my mother cry just like this when she took me past the house where she had grown up. Hazel directed Mama past the ramshackle little houses, a few stove-in trailers and remnants of barns. We stopped before a grassy swale under a thick grove of black locust trees. "Here it is," she said, "my home sweet home." She talked like that, like it was right out of a book. Before us was an old schoolhouse with long chapel windows set all around and two doors at the front, one for boys and one for girls. It was silvery gray, with just a few swipes of whitewash blurred across the clapboard. Hazel was eager to get out, and I had to hurry to get her walker to her before she stumbled in the tall grass. Pointing all the way at the spring house, the old chicken coop, she led Mama and me to the side door and up onto the porch. She fumbled in her big purse for the keys, but her hands were shaking so badly she asked me if I would unlock the door. I opened the tattered old screen door, and the key slid easily into the padlock. I held the door back for her, and she clumped inside and stopped. Just stopped and looked. It was quiet as a church. The air was cold inside and flowed out past me into the warm November afternoon. I started to go in, but my mother's hand on my arm stopped me. "Just let her be," her look said. The room before us was like a picture book about the olden days. A big old wood stove sat along the back wall. Cast iron frying pans hung alongside. Dish towels were neatly hung on dowels over the dry sink, and once white curtains framed the view of the grove outside. The ceilings were high, as befits an old schoolhouse, and festooned with garlands of tinsel, blue and silver, flickering in the breeze from the open door. Christmas cards outlined the door frames, fixed with yellowing tape. The whole kitchen was decked out for Christmas. An oilcloth of a holiday print covered the table, and plastic poinsettias swathed in cobwebs sat in jam jars as a centerpiece. The table was set for six places, and there was still food on the plates. The chairs pushed back, just as they were when dinner had been interrupted by the call from the hospital. "What a sight," she said. "Let's put this all to rights." Suddenly Hazel became as businesslike as if she'd just walked into her house after supper and found it below her housewifely standards. She set her walker aside and began gathering up the dishes from the long kitchen table and carrying them over to the sink. My mother tried to slow her down by asking for a tour of the place and saying we could get to tidying another time. Hazel took us into the parlor, where the skeleton of a Christmas tree stood with a pile of needles on the floor below. The ornaments hung like orphans on the bare branches. There was a little red drum and silver plastic birds with paint worn off and stubs where their tails should be. It had been a cozy room. There were rocking chairs and a couch, a little spindle-leg table and gas lamps. An old oak sideboard held a china pitcher and a basin painted with roses. A hand-embroidered scarf, cross-stitched in pink and blue, ran the length of the sideboard. "My goodness," she said, wiping the corner of her house dress over the thick layer of dust. "I've got to get after my dustin' in here." While she and Mama looked at the pretty dishes and sideboard, I wandered off to explore. I pushed one door open to a big unmade bed, heaped with blankets thrown back. Beside it was what looked like a potty chair, only grown-up size. It didn't smell very good in there, and I quickly retreated, not wanting to be caught snooping around. Another door gave way to a bedroom with a beautiful patchwork quilt and more tinsel garlands draped over the mirror above the dresser where a hurricane lamp sat, all caked in soot. Hazel leaned on my mother's arm as we circled around the clearing outside, pointing out trees she had planted and flower beds long overgrown. At the back of the house, under the oaks, was a clump of bare gray branches erupting with a froth of stringy yellow blossoms. "Why, looky here, it's my old medicine come to greet me," she said, and reached out to take the branch as if she was going to shake its hand. "I made me many a batch of this old witch hazel, and folks would come to me for it special. I'd cook up that bark in the fall and have it all winter to rub on aches and pains, burns and rashes. Everybody wanted it. There ain't hardly no hurt the woods don't have medicine for." "That's witch hazel," she said. "It's not just good for you outside, but inside too. Land sakes, flowers in November! The good Lord gave us witch hazel to remind us that there's always something good, even when it seems like there ain't. It just lightens your heavy heart, is what it does." After that first visit, Hazel would often call on a Sunday afternoon and ask, "Would y'all like to go for a ride?" My mother thought it important that we girls go along. It was like her insistence that we learn to bake bread and plant beans, things that didn't seem important then, but now I know differently. We got to pick hickory nuts from behind the old house, wrinkle our noses at the tilting outhouse, and root around in the barn for treasures while Mama and Hazel sat on the porch and talked. Hung on a nail right beside her door was an old metal black lunchbox, open and lined with what looked like shelf paper. There were remnants of a bird's nest within. Hazel had brought along a small plastic bag filled with cracker crumbs, which she scattered on the porch rail. "This little Jenny Wren has made her home here ever since Rowley passed on. This here was his lunch pail. Now she counts on me for house and home, and I can't let her down." A lot of people must have counted on Hazel when she was young and strong. She took us driving down her road, and we stopped at nearly every house but one. "Them are no count folks," she said, and looked away. The others seemed overjoyed to see Hazel again. My sister and I would follow the chickens around or pet the hound dogs while Mama and Hazel would visit with the neighbors. These folks were very different from the ones we met at school or at parties at the college. One lady reached out to tap my teeth. "Those are mighty purty teeth you got," she said. I'd never thought the teeth were worthy of a compliment, but then I hadn't met people before who had so few. I mostly remember their kindness, though. They were ladies Hazel had sung with in the choir of the little white church under the pines, ladies she had known since girlhood, and they cackled together about dances by the river and shook their heads sadly over the fate of kids who up and moved away. We'd go home in the afternoon with a basket of fresh eggs or a slice of cake for each of us, and Hazel just beaming. When winter began, our visits were fewer, and the light seemed to go out of Hazel's eyes. She sat at our kitchen table one day and said, "I know I shouldn't ask the good Lord for nothing more'n I already got, but how I wish I could have just one more Christmas in my dear old home. But those days are gone, gone with the wind." This was an ache for which the woods had no medicine. We were not going north to my grandma and grandpa's for Christmas that year, and my mother was taking it hard. It was still weeks until Christmas, but already she was baking up a fury while we girls strung popcorn and cranberries for the tree. She talked about how she would miss the snow, the smell of balsam and her family. And then she got an idea. It was to be a complete surprise. She got the house key from Sam and went to the old schoolhouse to see what she could do. She got on the phone to the rural electric co-op and arranged to have Hazel's power reconnected, just for those few days. As soon as the lights came on, it became clear how dirty it all was. There was no running water, so we had to bring jugs of water from home to sponge things down. The job was bigger than us, so Mama enlisted the help of some fraternity boys from her classes at the college who needed a community service project. They sure got one. Cleaning out that refrigerator rivaled any microbiology experiment. We drove up and down Hazel's Road, where I ran into houses with handmade invitations for all her old friends. There weren't too many, so Mama invited the college boys and her friends too. The house still had its Christmas decorations, but we made more. Paper chains and candles out of paper towel tubes. My dad cut a tree and set it up in the parlor with a box of lights stripped from the skeleton tree that had stood there before. We brought armloads of prickly red cedar boughs to decorate the tables and hung candy canes on the tree. The smell of cedar and peppermint filled the place where mold and mice had been only days ago. My mom and her friends baked plates of cookies. The morning of the party, the heat was on, the tree lights lit, and one by one, people started to arrive, clumping up the steps of the front porch. My sister and I played hostess while Mama drove off to get the guest of honor. "Hey, any of y'all feel like going for a ride?" Mama said, and bundled Hazel into her warm coat. "Well, where are we going?" Hazel asked. Her face gleamed like a candle when she stepped into her home sweet home, filled with light and friends. My mother pinned a Christmas corsage, a plastic bell with golden glitter that she had found on the dresser, to Hazel's dress. Hazel moved through her house like a queen that day. My father and my sister played their violins in the parlor, silent night and joy to the world, while I ladled out sweet red punch. I don't remember much more about the party, except Hazel falling asleep on the way home. Just a few years later, we left Kentucky to move back north. My mom was glad to be going home, to have her maples instead of oaks, but saying goodbye to Hazel was hard. She saved it for last. Hazel gave her a going-away present, a rocking chair, and a little box with a couple of her old-time Christmas ornaments inside, a celluloid drum, and a silver plastic bird missing its tail feathers. My mother still hangs them on her tree every year and tells the story of that party as if it were the best Christmas she ever had. We got word that Hazel had died a couple of years after we moved. "Gone? All gone with the wind," she would have said. There are some aches which Hazel can't assuage. For those, we need each other. My mother and Hazel Barnett, unlikely sisters, I suppose, learned well from the plants they both loved. They made a balm for loneliness together, a strengthening tea for the pain of longing. Now, when the red leaves are all down and the geese are gone, I go looking for Witch Hazel. It never lets me down, always carrying the memory of that Christmas and how their friendship was medicine for each other. I cherish a Witch Hazel kind of day, a scrap of color, a light in the window when winter is closing all around. A Mother's Work. I wanted to be a good mother, that's all, like Sky Woman, maybe. Somehow this led me into hip waders filled with brown water. The rubber boots that were intended to keep the pond at bay now contain it, and me. And one tadpole. I feel a flutter at the back of my other knee. Make that two tadpoles. When I left Kentucky to go house hunting in upstate New York, my two small daughters gave me an explicit wish list for our new home. Trees big enough for tree forts, one apiece. A stone walk lined with pansies, like the one in Larkin's favorite book. A red barn, a pond to swim in, a purple bedroom. the last request gave me some comfort. Their dad had just pulled up stakes, left the country, and us. He said that he no longer wanted a life with so much responsibility, so the responsibility was all mine. I was grateful that if nothing else, I could at least paint a bedroom purple. All winter long, I looked at house after house, none of which made sense for either my budget or my hopes. Real estate listings, 3 bedrooms, 2 bath, raised ranch, landscaping, are pretty thin on vital information like trees suitable for tree houses. I confess I was thinking more about mortgages and school districts and whether I was going to end up in a trailer park at the end of the road. But the girl's wish list surfaced in my mind when the agent drove me to an old farmhouse surrounded by immense sugar maples, 2 with low spreading branches, perfect for tree houses. This was a possibility. But there was the matter of sagging shutters and a porch that hadn't seen level in half a century. On the plus side, it sat on 7 acres, including what was described as a trout pond, which was only a smooth expanse of ice surrounded by trees at the time. The house was empty, cold and unloved, but as I opened doors to the musty rooms, wonder of wonders, the corner bedroom was the color of spring violets. It was a sign. This is where we would fall to earth. We moved in that spring, and not long after, the girls and I cobbled together tree forts in the maples, 1 apiece. Imagine our surprise when the snow melted to reveal a flagstone walk overgrown with weeds leading to the front door. We met the neighbors, explored the hilltops with picnic luncheons, planted pansies, and started to put down the roots of happiness. Being the good mother, good enough for 2 parents, seemed within my grasp. All that remained was to complete the wish list for home was a swimmable pond. The deed described a deep spring-fed pond, and 100 years ago it might have been exactly that. One of my neighbors, whose family has been here for generations, told me that it was the favorite pond in the valley. In summer, after haying, the boys would park their wagons and hike up to the pond for a swim. "We'd throw off our clothes and jump in," he said. "The way it sits, no girls would be able to see us, buck naked as we were. And cold? That spring kept the water icy cold, and it felt so good after working hay. We'd lie in the grass afterward just to warm up." Our pond nestles in the hill up behind the house. The slopes rise around it on 3 sides, and a copse of apple trees on the other entirely shield it from view. At its back is a limestone cliff where rock was quarried to build my house more than 200 years ago. It was hard to believe that anyone would dip even a toe in that pond today. My daughter certainly would not. It was so choked with green that you could not tell where the weeds left off and the water began. The ducks didn't help. If anything, they were what you might politely call a major source of nutrient input. They were so cute in the feed store, just downy yellow fluff connecting outsized beaks and enormous orange feet, waddling around in a crate of wood chips. It was almost spring, almost Easter. All the good reasons not to take them home evaporated with the girls' delight. Wouldn't a good mother adopt ducklings? Isn't that what a pond is for? We kept them in a cardboard box in the garage with a heat lamp, closely watched so neither box nor ducklings would ignite. The girls accepted full responsibility for their care and dutifully fed and cleaned them. I came home from work one afternoon to see them floating in the kitchen sink, quacking and dabbling, shaking water off their backs while the girls just beamed. The condition of the sink should have given me a clue of what was to come. For the next few weeks, they ate and defecated with equal enthusiasm. But within a month, we carried the box of 6 glossy white ducks up to the pond and released them. They preened and splashed. All was well for the first few days. But apparently, in the absence of their own good mother to protect and teach them, they didn't have the essential survival skills for life outside the box. Every day there was 1 less duck. 5 remained. then four, and then finally three, who had the right stuff to fend off foxes and snapping turtles and the marsh hawk who had taken to cruising the shore. These three flourished. They looked so placid, so pastoral, gliding over the pond. But the pond itself began to get even greener than before. They were perfect pets until winter came and their delinquent tendencies emerged. Despite the little hut we made for them, a floating A-frame lodge with a wraparound porch, despite the corn we showered around them like confetti, they were discontent. They developed a fondness for dog food in the warmth of my back porch. I would come out on a January morning to find the dog bowl empty and the dog cowering outside while three snowy white ducks sat in a row on the bench, wiggling their tails in contentment. It gets cold where I live. Really cold. Duck turds were frozen into coiled mounds like half-finished clay pots solidly affixed to my porch floor. It took an ice pick to chip them away. I would shoo them, close the porch door, and lay a trail of corn kernels back up to the pond, and they would follow along in a gabbling line, but the next morning they'd be back. Winter and a daily dose of duck splats must freeze up the part of the brain devoted to compassion for animals, for I began to hope for their demise. Unfortunately, I didn't have the heart to dispatch them, and who among our rural friends would welcome the dubious gift of ducks in the dead of winter, even with plum sauce? I secretly contemplated spraying them with fox lure, or tying slices of roast beef to their legs in hopes of interesting the coyotes that howled at the ridgetop. But instead, I was a good mother. I fed them, rasped my shovel over the crust on the porch floor, and waited for spring. One balmy day, they trundled back up to the pond, and within a month they were gone, leaving piles of feathers like a drift of late snow on the shore. The ducks were gone, but their legacy lived on. By May, the pond was a thick soup of green algae. A pair of Canada geese had settled in to take their place and raised a brood under the willows. One afternoon, I walked up to see if the goose babies had sprouted pin feathers yet, only to hear a distressed quacking. A fuzzy brown gosling out for a swim had gotten snared in the floating masses of algae. It was squawking and flapping its wings trying to get free. While I tried to think of how to rescue it, it gave a mighty kick and popped up to the surface, where it began to walk on the algal mat. That was a moment of resolve for me. You should not be able to walk on a pond. It should be an invitation to wildlife, not a snare. The likelihood of making the pond swimmable, even for geese, seemed remote at best. But I'm an ecologist, so I was confident that I could at least improve the situation. The word ecology is derived from Greek oikos, the word for home. I could use ecology to make a good home for goslings and girls. Like many an old farm pond, mine was the victim of eutrophication, the natural process of nutrient enrichment that comes with age. Generations of algae and lily pads and fallen leaves and autumn's apples falling into the pond build up the sediments, layering the once clean gravel at the bottom in a sheet of muck. All those nutrients fueled the growth of new plants, which fueled the growth of more new plants in an accelerating cycle. This is the way for many ponds. The bottom gradually fills in until the pond becomes a marsh, and someday maybe a meadow and then a forest. Ponds grow old, and though I will too, I like the ecological idea of aging as progressive enrichment rather than progressive loss. Sometimes the process of eutrophication is accelerated by human activities. Nutrient-rich runoff from fertilized fields or septic tanks ends up in the water, where it supports exponential growth of algae. My pond was buffered from such influences. Its source was a cold spring coming out of the hill, and a swath of trees on the uphill side formed a nitrogen-grabbing filter for runoff from the surrounding pastures. My battle was not with pollution, but with time. Making my pond swimmable would be an exercise in turning back time. That's just what I wanted, to turn back time. My daughters were growing up too fast, my time as a mother slipping away, and my promise of a swimming pond yet to be fulfilled. Being a good mother meant fixing the pond for my kids. A highly productive food chain might be good for frogs and herons, but not for swimming. The best swimming lakes are not eutrophic, but cold, clear, and oligotrophic, or poor in nutrients. I carried my small solo canoe up to the pond to serve as a floating platform for algae removal. I envisioned scooping up the algae with a long-handled rake, filling the canoe as if it were a garbage scow, emptying it on the shore, and then going for a nice swim. But only the swimming part worked out, and it wasn't nice. As I tried to skim the algae, I discovered that they hung like sheer green curtains through the water. If you reach far out of a light canoe and try to lift a heavy mat of algae at the end of a rake, physics dictates that swimming will occur. My attempts at skimming were useless. I was addressing only the symptoms of scum and not the cause. I read as much as I could about pond rehabilitation and weighed my options. To undo what time and ducks had accomplished, I needed to remove nutrients from the pond, not just skim the foam. When I waded in the shallow end of the pond, the muck squished between my toes. But beneath it, I could feel the clean gravel that was the pond's original basin. Maybe I could dredge up the muck and cart it away in buckets. But when I brought my broadest snow shovel to scoop up the mud, by the time it reached the surface, there was a brown cloud all around me and a mere handful of soil on the shovel. I stood in the water laughing out loud. Shoveling muck was like trying to catch wind in a butterfly net. Next, I used old window screens to make a sieve that we could lift up through the sediments. But the muck was far too fine, and my improvised net came up empty. This was not ordinary mud. The organic matter in the sediments occurs as tiny particles, dissolved nutrients that flocculate in specks small enough to be bite-sized snacks for zooplankton. Clearly, I was powerless to haul the nutrients out of the water. But fortunately, the plants were not. A mat of algae is really nothing more than dissolved phosphorus and nitrogen made solid through the alchemy of photosynthesis. I couldn't remove nutrients by shoveling, but once they are fixed into the bodies of plants, they can be forked out of the water with the application of biceps and bent back and carted away by the wheelbarrow full. The average phosphate molecule in a farm pond has a cycling time of less than 2 weeks from the time it is absorbed out of the water, made into living tissue, is eaten or dies, decomposes, and is recycled back to feed yet another algal strand. My plan was to interrupt this endless recycling by capturing nutrients in plants and hauling them away before they could once again be turned into algae. I could slowly, steadily, deplete the stores of nutrients circulating in the pond. I'm a botanist by trade, and so of course I needed to know who these algae were. There are probably as many kinds of algae as there are species of tree, and I would do a disservice to their lives and to my task if I didn't know who they were. You wouldn't try to restore a forest without knowing what kind of trees you were working with. So I scooped up a jar full of green slime and took it to my microscope with the top screwed tightly to contain the smell. I teased apart the slippery green wads into tiny wisps that would fit beneath my microscope. In this single tuft were long threads of cladophora, shining like satin ribbons. Wound around them were translucent strands of spirogyra, in which the chloroplasts spiral like a green staircase. The whole green field was in motion, with iridescent tumbleweeds of volvox and pulsing euglenoids stretching their way along the strands. So much life in a single drop of water. Water that previously looked like scum in a jar. Here were my partners in restoration. Progress was slow with pond restoration hours squeezed between years' worth of Girl Scout meetings, bake sales, camping trips, and a more than full-time job. All moms have treasured ways to spend the few precious hours they have to themselves, curling up with a book or sewing, but I mostly went to the water. The birds and the wind and the quiet were what I needed. This was one place where I somehow felt as if I could make things right. At school, I taught ecology, but on a Saturday afternoon, when the kids were off at a friend's, I got to do ecology. After the canoe debacle, I decided it was wiser to stand on the shore with a rake and stretch out as far as I could reach. The rake brought sticks draped in cladophora like a comb matted with long green hair. Every stroke of the rake combed up another sheet from the bottom and added to a quickly growing mound, which I had to get out of the watershed by moving it downhill from the pond. If I left it to rot on the shore, the nutrients released in decay would return to the pond in short order. I flung the wads of algae onto a sled, my kid's little red plastic toboggan, and dragged it up the steep bank to empty it into the waiting wheelbarrow. I really didn't want to stand in the mucky ooze, so I worked cautiously from the edges in old sneakers. I could reach out and dredge up heaps of algae, but there was so much more just beyond my reach. Sneakers evolved to Wellingtons, extending my sphere of influence just enough for me to know that it was ineffective, and thus Wellingtons came to waders. But waders give you a false sense of security, and before long, I reached just a little too far and felt the icy pond rush in over their tops. Waders are darn heavy when they fill up, and I found myself anchored in the muck. A good mother does not drown. The next time, I just wore shorts. I simply gave myself up to the task. I remember the liberation of just walking right into my waist the first time, the lightness of my t-shirt floating around me, the swirl of the water against my bare skin. I finally felt at home. The tickles at my legs were just wisps of spirogyra, the nudges just curious perch. Now I could see the algal curtains stretched out before me, much more beautiful than dangling at the end of my rake. I could see the way cladophora bloomed from old sticks and watch diving beetles swim among them. I developed a new relationship with mud. Instead of trying to protect myself from it, I became oblivious to it, noticing its presence only when I would go back to the house and see strands of algae caught in my hair or the water in the shower turning decidedly brown. I came to know the feel of the gravelly bottom below the muck, the sucking mud by the cattails, and the cold stillness where the bottom dropped away from the shallows. Transformation is not accomplished by tentative wading at the edge. One spring day, my rake came up draped with a mass of algae so heavy it bent the bamboo handle. I let it drip to lighten the load and then flipped it onto the shore. I was about to go for another load when I heard a wet smacking from the pile, the slap of a watery tail. A lump was wiggling in a frenzy below the surface of the heaped algae. I picked the threads apart, opening the weave to see what was struggling within. A plump brown body, a bullfrog tadpole as big as my thumb was caught there. Tadpoles can swim easily through a net that is suspended in the water, but when the net is drawn up by the rake, it collapses around them like a purse seine. I picked him up, squishy and cold, between thumb and forefinger, and tossed him back into the pond, where he rested, suspended for a moment in the water, and then swam off. The next rake came up in a smooth, dripping sheet, studded with so many tadpoles that they looked like nuts caught in a tray of peanut brittle. I bent and untangled them. Every one. This was a problem. There was so much to rake. I could dredge the algae out, slap it into piles, and be done with it. I could work so much faster if I didn't have to stop and pick tadpoles from the tangle of every moral dilemma. I told myself that my intention was not to hurt them. I was just trying to improve the habitat, and they were the collateral damage. But my good intentions meant nothing to tadpoles if they struggled and died in a compost pile. I sighed, but I knew what I had to do. I was driven to this chore by a mothering urge to make a swimmable pond. In the process, I could hardly sacrifice another mother's children, who, after all, already have a pond to swim in. Now I was not only a pond raker, but a tadpole plucker. It was amazing what I found in the mesh of algae. Predaceous diving beetles with sharp black mandibles, small fish, dragonfly larvae. I stuck my fingers in to free a wiggle and felt a sharp pain like a bee sting. My hand flinched back with a big crayfish attached to my fingertip. A whole food web was dangling from my rake, and those were just the critters I could see, just the tip of the iceberg, the top of the food chain. Under my microscope, I had seen the web of algae teeming with invertebrates, copepods, daphnia, whirling rotifers, and creatures so much smaller, thread-like worms, globes of green algae, protozoans with cilia beating in unison. I knew they were there, but I couldn't possibly pick them out, so I bargained with myself over the chain of responsibility and tried to convince myself that their demise served a greater good. Raking a pond provides you with a lot of mental free space for philosophizing. As I raked and plucked, it challenged my conviction that all lives are valuable, protozoan or not. As a theoretical matter, I hold this to be true, but on a practical level it gets murky, the spiritual and the pragmatic bumping heads. With every rake, I knew that I was prioritizing. Short, single-cell lives were ended because I wanted a clear pond. I'm bigger, I have a rake, so I win. That's not a worldview I readily endorse. But it didn't keep me awake at night or halt my efforts. I simply acknowledged the choices I was making. The best I could do was to be respectful and not let the small lives go to waste. I plucked out whatever wee beasties I could, and the rest went into the compost pile to start the cycle again as soil. At first I hauled carts of freshly raked algae, but I soon realized that trundling hundreds of pounds of water was hard work. I learned to heap the algae on the shore and watch it dribble moisture back to the pond. In the following days, the algae bleached in the sun into light papery sheets, easily lifted into the wheelbarrow. Filamentous algae like Spirogyra and Cladophora have a nutrient content equivalent to that of high-quality forage grasses. I was hauling away the equivalent nutrient load of bales of good dairy hay. Load after load of algae domed up in the compost pile, on its way to making good black humus. The pond was literally feeding the garden, Cladophora reborn as carrots. I began to see a difference in the pond. A span of days would go by when the surface was clear, but the fuzzy green mats always returned. I began to notice other sponges for my pond's excess nutrients in addition to the algae. All along the shore, the willows reached their feathery red roots into the shallow water to troll for nitrogen and phosphorus, to pull into their root systems, to become leaves and willow withes. I came along the shore with my loppers and cut the willows, stem by swaying stem. Dragging the piles of willow branches away, I was removing storehouses of nutrients they had sucked from the pond bottom. The brush pile in the field grew taller, soon to be browsed by cottontails and redistributed far and wide as rabbit droppings. Willow responds vigorously to cutting and sends up long, straight shoots that can tower over my head in a single growing season. I left the thickets away from the water for rabbits and songbirds, but those right at the shore I cut and bundled for making baskets. The larger stems became the foundation for garden trellises for pole beans and morning glories. I also gathered mint and other herbs along the banks. As with the willows, the more I picked, the more it seemed to grow back. Everything I took moved the pond a step closer to clear. Every cup of mint tea struck a blow for nutrient removal. Cleaning the pond by cutting willows really seemed to help. I cut with renewed enthusiasm, moving in a mindless rhythm with my loppers. Snick, 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 clearing whole swaths of shoreline as willow stems fell at my feet. And then something, perhaps a movement glimpsed out of the corner of my eye, perhaps a silent plea, made me stop. In the last stem left standing was a beautiful little nest, a cup woven sweetly of juncus rushes and thread-like roots around a fork in the tree, a marvel of homemaking. I peered inside, and there were three eggs the size of lima beans lying in a circlet of pine needles. What a treasure I had nearly destroyed in my zeal to improve the habitat. Nearby, the mother, a yellow warbler, flitted in the bushes, calling an alarm. I was so quick and single-minded about what I was doing that I forgot to look. I forgot to acknowledge that creating the home that I wanted for my children jeopardized the homemaking of other mothers whose intents were no different from mine. It came to me once again that restoring a habitat, no matter how well-intentioned, produces casualties. We set ourselves up as arbiters of what is good, when often our standards of goodness are driven by narrow interests, by what we want. I piled the cut brush back up near the nest in some semblance of the protective cover I had destroyed, and sat on a rock, concealed on the other side of the pond, to see if she would come back. What did she think as she watched me come closer and closer, laying waste to the home she had carefully chosen, threatening her family? There are powerful forces of destruction loose in the world, advancing inexorably toward her children and mine. The onslaught of progress, well-intentioned to improve human habitat, threatens the nest I've chosen for my children as surely as I threatened hers. What does a good mother do? I continued to clear out the algae, let the silt settle, and it looked better. But I went back a week later to a foamy green mass. It's kind of like cleaning the kitchen. You get everything put away, wipe off the countertops, and before you know it, there are drips of peanut butter and jelly everywhere, and you have to do it all over again. Life adds up. It's eutrophic. But I could see ahead to a time when my kitchen would stay too clean. I would have an oligotrophic kitchen. Without the girls to mess it up, I would be longing for leftover cereal bowls, for a eutrophic kitchen, for signs of life. I pull my red toboggan to the other end of the pond and start to work in the shallows. Immediately, my rake gets stalled with a heavy load of weeds that I drag slowly to the surface. This mat has a different weight and texture than the slippery sheets of cladophora that I've been dredging. I lay it down on the grass for a closer look, and spread the film with my fingers until it stretches into what looks like a green fishnet stocking, a fine mesh network like a drift net suspended in the water. This is hydrodictyon. I stretch it between my fingers and it glistens, almost weightless, after the water has drained away. As orderly as a honeycomb, hydrodictyon is a geometric surprise in the seemingly random stew of a murky pond. It hangs in the water, a colony of tiny nets, all fused together. Under the microscope, the fabric of hydrodictyon is made up of tiny, six-sided polygons, a mesh of linked green cells that surround the holes of the net. It multiplies quickly because of a unique means of clonal reproduction. Inside each of the net cells, daughter cells are born. They arrange themselves into hexagons, neat replicas of the mother net. In order to disperse her young, the mother cell must disintegrate, freeing the daughter cells into the water. The floating newborn hexagons fuse with others, forging new connections and weaving a new net. I look out at the expanse of hydrodictyon visible just below the surface. I imagine the liberation of new cells, the daughters spinning off on their own. What does a good mother do when mothering time is done? As I stand in the water, my eyes brim and dropped salt tears into the fresh water at my feet. Fortunately, my daughters are not clones of their mother, nor must I disintegrate to set them free. But I wonder how the fabric is changed when the release of daughters tears a hole. Does it heal over quickly, or does the empty space remain? And how do the daughter cells make new connections? How is the fabric rewoven? Hydrodictyon is a safe place, a nursery for fish and insects, a shelter from predators, a safety net for the small beings of the pond. Hydrodictyon, Latin for the water net. What a curious thing. A fish net catches fish. A bug net catches bugs. But a water net catches nothing, save what cannot be held. Mothering is like that, a net of living threads to lovingly encircle what it cannot possibly hold, what will eventually move through it. But right then, my job was reversing succession, turning back time to make these waters swimmable for my daughters. So I wiped my eyes, and with all due respect for the lessons of Hydrodictian, I raked it up onto the shore. When my sister came to visit, her kids, raised in the dry California hills, were smitten with water. They waded after frogs and splashed with abandon while I worked at the algae. My brother-in-law called out from the shade, "Hey, who's the biggest kid here?" I can't deny it. I've never outgrown my desire to play in the mud. But isn't play the way we get limbered up for the work of the world? My sister defended my pond raking with the reminder that it was sacred play. Among our Potawatomi people, women are the keepers of water. We carry the sacred water to ceremonies and act on its behalf. Women have a natural bond with water because we are both life bearers, my sister said. We carry our babies in internal ponds, and they come forth into the world on a wave of water. It's our responsibility to safeguard the water for all our relations. Being a good mother includes the caretaking of water. On Saturday mornings, Sunday afternoons, year after year, I would go to the solitude of the pond and get to work. I tried grass carp and barley straw, and every new change provoked a new reaction. The job is never over. It simply changes from one task to the next. What I'm looking for, I suppose, is balance, and that's a moving target. Balance is not a passive resting place. It takes work. Balancing the giving and the taking, the raking out and the putting in. Skating in winter, peepers in the spring, summer sunbathing, autumn bonfires, swimmable or not, the pond became like another room in our house. I planted sweetgrass around the edge. The girls and their friends had campfires on the flat meadow of the shore, slumber parties in the tent, summer suppers on the picnic table, and long sun-washed afternoons sunbathing, rising on one elbow when the gust of a heron's wings stirred the air. I cannot count the hours I've spent there. Almost without notice, the hours stretched out to years. My dog used to bound up the hill after me and race back and forth along the shore as I worked. As the pond grew clearer, he grew more feeble and would always go with me to sleep in the sun and drink at the edge. We buried him nearby. The pond built my muscles, wove my baskets, mulched my garden, made my tea, and trellised my morning glories. Our lives became entwined in ways both material and spiritual. It's been a balanced exchange. I worked on the pond, and the pond worked on me, and together we made a good home. One spring Saturday, while I was raking algae, there was a rally downtown in support of the cleanup of Onondaga Lake, on whose shore our city stands. The lake is held sacred by the Onondaga Nation, the people who have fished and gathered on its shore for millennia. It was here that the great Haudenosaunee, or Iroquois, Confederacy was formed. Today, Onondaga Lake has the dubious reputation of being one of the most polluted lakes in the country. The problem at Onondaga Lake is not too much life, but too little. As I dredge up another heavy rakeful of slime, I feel also the weight of responsibility. In one short life, where does responsibility lie? I spend countless hours improving the water quality of my half-acre pond. I stand here raking algae so that my kids can swim in clear water while standing silent on the cleanup of Onondaga, where no one can swim. Being a good mother means teaching your children to care for the world. And so I've shown the girls how to grow a garden, how to prune an apple tree. The apple tree leans out over the water and makes for a shadowy arbor. In spring, a drift of pink and white blossoms and plumes of fragrance wafting down the hill and a rain of petals on the water. For years now, I've watched her seasons, from frothy pink blossoms to gently swelling ovaries as the petals fall away, to sour green marbles of adolescent fruit, to the ripe golden apples of September. That tree has been a good mother. Most years she nurtures a full crop of apples, gathering the energy of the world into herself and passing it on. She sends her young out into the world, well provisioned for the journey, packaged in sweetness to share with the world. My girls, too, have grown up strong and beautiful here, rooted like the willows and flying off like their wind-blown seeds. And now, after 12 years, the pond is nearly swimmable, if you don't mind the weeds that tickle your legs. My older daughter left for college long before the pond was cleaned. I recruited my younger daughter to help me carry buckets of pea gravel to pour ourselves a beach. Having become so intimate with muck and tadpoles, I don't mind the occasional green strand that wraps around my arm. But the beach makes a small ramp that lets me wade in and plunge into the deep, clear pool at the center without raising a cloud. On a hot day, it feels wonderful to submerge in the icy spring water and watch the pollywogs flee. Emerging with a shiver, I have to pluck bits of algae from my wet skin. The girls will take a quick dip to please me, but in truth, I've not succeeded in turning back time. It's Labor Day now, the last of summer vacation, a day to savor the mellow sunshine. This summer is my last with a child at home. Yellow apples plop into the water from an overhanging tree. I am mesmerized by the yellow apples on the dark surface of the pond, globes of light dancing and turning. The breeze off the hill sets the water in motion, in a circular current from west to east and back again. The wind is stirring the pond, so gently you wouldn't see it, but for the fruit. The apples ride the current, a procession of yellow rafts following each other along the shoreline. They move quickly from under the apple tree and follow the curve beneath the elms. As the wind carries them away, more fall from the tree, so that the whole pond surface is stenciled with moving arcs of yellow, like a procession of yellow candles against a dark night. They spiral around and around in an ever-widening gyre. Paula Gunn Allen, in her book Grandmothers of the Light, writes of the changing roles of women as they spiral through the phases of life, like the changing face of the moon. We begin our lives, she says, walking the way of the daughter. This is the time for learning, for gathering experiences in the shelter of our parents. We move next to self-reliance, when the necessary task of the age is to learn who you are in the world. The path brings us next to the way of the mother. This, Gunn relates, is a time when her spiritual knowledge and values are all called into service of her children. Life unfolds in a growing spiral, as children begin their own paths, and mothers, rich with knowledge and experience, have a new task set before them. Allen tells us that our strengths turn now to a circle wider than our own children, to the well-being of the community. The net stretches larger and larger. The circle bends round again, and grandmothers walk the way of the teacher, becoming models for younger women to follow. And in the fullness of age, Allen reminds us, our work is not yet done. The spiral widens farther and farther, so that the sphere of a wise woman is beyond herself, beyond her family, beyond the human community, embracing the planet, mothering the earth. So it is my grandchildren who will swim in this pond, and others whom the years will bring. The circle of care grows larger, and caregiving for my little pond spills over to caregiving for other waters. The outlet from my pond drains downhill to my good neighbor's pond. What I do here matters. Everybody lives downstream. My pond drains to the brook, to the creek, to a great and needful lake. The water net connects us all. I have shed tears into that flow when I thought that motherhood would end. But the pond has shown me that being a good mother doesn't end with creating a home where just my children can flourish. A good mother grows into a richly eutrophic old woman, knowing that her work doesn't end until she creates a home where all of life's beings can flourish. There are grandchildren to nurture, and frog children, nestlings, goslings, seedlings, and spores. And I still want to be a good mother.